All right. Thank you, everyone, for showing up at the War College at the 2015 Celesticon. Our first speaker of the War College is Frank Chadwick. You probably have read his bio in the program book and then online. Frank is a Hall of Fame inductee for the game industry. He is also currently a published author in the science fiction and fantasy genre, working with Bain Books. But one of the things that he has done, he's a military historian like myself, and he was doing research for Victory Point's game ETO, correct?
That's correct.
Which is a big monster game.
Yeah.
And you found fascinating information about that, and he's going to share it with us today. Frank, please.
Thank you. The genesis of this project, as Dana suggested, was the game design European Theater of Operation for Victory Point Games. It grew out of my introductory game that I did years and years ago, I forget how many years, called Battle for Moscow. Very small. We gave it away as a free game to get people interested in war gaming. It was a 8.5 by 11 map and had about 60 counters, about 7 turns covering the Battle for Moscow, Soviet field armies, German corps, all the basics of war gaming. And it was a fun game. It was a really good game. And it's kind of hung around in many different editions since then. And so Alan Emmerich at Victory Point Games, there's something we could do with that. And I said, well, yeah. And so I did a game called The Arduous Beginning, which was Army Group Setter's initial campaign in Barbarossa. And then I did Battle for Leningrad, Battle for Kiev. So all three of those games, which they call the Battles in Russia things, cover that initial attack by Army Group Setter. And they're kind of mateable, sort of. And they kind of hook into Battle for Moscow, sort of. And so this immediately suggested to them and to some players, you know, why don't you do kind of a linked version of all this and kind of do all of the Eastern Front? And then that, of course, suggested to us, well, if we do that, why don't we do the rest of it, too? So yeah, that was the genesis of this monster game that came out of a very small and very simple, very introductory game. But if you're going to do something like that, if you're going to do a combined campaign game of covering multiple years, you can't simply have an order of battle. You really need a strategic production decision, a system, because the decisions that people make in terms of how they allocate their strategic resources are central to how the war is fought. But the game system that we used was a very simple game system. It's a very clean game system. It's not designed to be, and it doesn't, in the playtest, it does not play like monster games in that you've got stacks, you know, walls of stacks of counters, you know, on each side, and as you're going through it, sorting. It's a much cleaner game than this. It's got lots of maps, but the counter density is very low. So it's mechanically a very streamlined system. We wanted to keep that in every aspect of the game, because we have to put in air power, we have to put in naval, we have to do strategic production. So with that in mind, I kind of tackled this production system, kind of looked at it as in terms of what I could find that was the simplest determinants of the strategic production decision-making and bottlenecks with the belligerents had during the war. And it comes down to three things: manpower, industry, and fuel. And I will talk about those in sequence. First one is manpower. The basic increment that I picked, the metrics that I use for manpower, and we'll talk a little bit about them in a second, but what I came to with the basic increment is 10 million citizens. The basic increment of population for evaluating different nations was 10 million citizens. Based on that, I did the number of major cities or recruiting cities, because I wanted it geographically based, because as you take, as parts of a country are overrun, it reduces the manpower capability of that country to mobilize. The number of major cities was based on the population divided by 10 million, right? So if you got 90 million people in the city, that means you're going to have 10 million cities, 9 cities scattered around that will show the population distribution. The replacement points used in the game, it represented about 25,000 men, which is about a division slice. You know, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the term division slice, but if you take a field army and you divide it by the number, divisions are usually about 10,000 men. But if you divide the people in a field army by the number of divisions, you end up with a much bigger chunk than that because you've got all these non-divisional support units. And so that's called a division slice. And so 25,000 men is a pretty reasonable division slice in most armies. So based upon those metrics, I want to take a look at Germany and see what we come up with. The pre-war population of Germany was between 80 and 87 million, depending upon how you count Bohemia and Moravia. But including Bohemia and Moravia, 87 million people, which we round up to 90 million. That gives us nine major cities or recruiting cities in Germany: Berlin, Breslau, Hamburg, Leipzig, Vienna, Munich, Köln, Essen, and Prague, which are the largest of the, which are the nine largest cities in Greater Germany at that time. Here's how many people Germany mobilizes during the war per year. In 1940, they mobilized 1.8 million people, which is 2% of the pre-war population. Which, and that 25,000 man increment comes out to 72 replacement points, or 18 replacement points per order, which looks a lot like two per city to me. in 1941, we get another 1.8 million mobilized. 1942, 1.6 million. 1943, 1.6 million. 1944, 1.2 million. 1945, 0.3 million. But that's in a fairly short amount of time, because they stopped mobilizing in April. Probably it's about 1% annualized by 1945. You can see that the ability to mobilize manpower declines over time, because if you're really cranking it out, I mean, you're not replacing this many people every year in your economy. So at a certain point, you start exhausting the reserves that you can squeeze out. But that said, the war also ends in 45, and the game is set up to end at the end of 45. So I decided that it was not worth it in the game to track that gradual decline. And it was easier to simply say that the country, for the purposes of the period we were covering, every country could make a fairly sustained rate of 1.8% of its population, which means that per increment of 10 million citizens, it would get 180,000 per year, 45,000 per quarter, or effectively two replacement points per city. Okay? So, conclusion, when at war, a nation can generate about two replacement points per quarter per 10 million people. So that was my baseline there, and that seemed to work pretty well in terms of how many people are actually generated. Here is some comparisons of the major and some not-so-major countries, but a pretty good spread of countries in the European theater during the war. This is their 1939 population, some modification in the case of the Soviet Union. USSR, 170 million, that would be 17 cities. That actually is 190 million in June of 1941, because at that time they have incorporated the three Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, Western Poland, Bessarabia, and a little bit of Finland, although I think there's more reindeer than people in the part of Finland that they incorporated. United States of America, although it's not in the European theater, it certainly has it, it gets involved in it, 130 million people, 13 cities if we were to actually map the United States. Germany, we've already talked about it, 90 million, nine cities. United Kingdom, 50 million, France, 40, Italy, 40, Poland and Spain, each 30, Turkey, Romania, and Yugoslavia, each 20, and then there's a raft of nations with about 10 million. Belgium, Holland, Hungary, you know, a few others. But Sweden, Finland actually has quite a few less. And then there are some that are substantially smaller than that, including Finland. But that gives you an idea about how many cities and about the quantity of manpower on a sustained basis proportionally that each of these countries can contribute to the military. Total number of people mobilized. Here's just some snapshots of total number of people mobilized. Millions of men inducted, actually millions of people, because there were In the case of the Soviet Union in particular, there's substantial numbers of female in the military. Soviet Union, 26 million, which is 13.6% of the 1941 population, over the course of the war were taking armed forces. The United States, 12.5 million, 9.6% of its 39 population. Germany, 12 million, 13.3%, almost as much mobilized as the Soviet Union. The United Kingdom, 5.5 million, 11% of the 30. So yeah, 10 to 14% is about where people were in their mobilization in terms of what percentage of their pre-war population total they brought under arms. So that's manpower. That's manpower. Manpower is the basis. You kind of got to start with that. And I'll say something about although. I don't mean this as a criticism of other games, but there are a number of games that treat this thing as just kind of universal production points without differentiating between population and industry and things. And the reason I found that unsatisfying and not really getting the job done is there are countries that are quite populous that can put very large very large armies in the field, but they can't put. But they don't have the ability to arm them as well. They can't put large mechanized formations in the field. They can't put large navies at sea. So there is clearly a difference between industrial base and manpower that I think needs to be addressed, at least for me to find satisfying in terms of how I wanted the game to work. So the second basic component of that is industry. And my metrics were, the basic increment I came to was 250,000 tons of military steel. And I'll explain kind of how we got there in a little bit. But I found it, one of the things I found interesting was that most countries that I looked at tended to devote about 50% of their steel output to civilian projects throughout the war, including both Germany and the Soviet Union. Which sounds, I mean, the first time you hear that, you say, refrigerators? You know, I thought they weren't doing civilian goods. But civilian projects are not really consumer goods. They include things like railroads, steel mills, merchant shipping, and other critical infrastructure needs. If you're going to build a tank factory, that's civilian production. The tanks that come out of it are military production, but for the most part, but actually building factories and things like that is civilian production. And there's a lot of steel everywhere that goes into, quote, civilian projects throughout that nevertheless are essential to a war effort. But they're just not particularly, they're not specifically military things. And they aren't things that necessarily show up as outputs in the military, in the production end of the military thing. So, the second thing is, why steel? The main limitation on the output of heavy military equipment, armored vehicles, artillery, ammunition, warships, and the infrastructure in the to maintain them is steel. Aircraft, it's less so, but aircraft's kind of the only major thing that really is not, it's almost entirely steel dependent. From the wage of destruction, the making and breaking of the Nazi economy. From September 1939 to the end of 43, there's a near perfect correlation between the allocation of steel to ammunition production and the quantity of ammunition produced. When plenty of steel was allocated, ammunition production was buoyant. When the steel supply was restricted, so was the price of ammunition. Well, duh, you know. That's ammunition is made mostly out of steel. And so if you don't have steel, you're not going to produce much ammunition. So that's why I use steel as the critical determinant in heavy industry for these things. So my conclusion was to get 250,000 tons of military steel, with a point, whatever that is, and we'll kind of show you what that means, you need to produce 500,000 total tons of steel because about only half your total production is usually going to go to military purposes. Since production of the game is quarterly, that means a nation produces 1 point of military steel per quarter for every 2 million tons of steel it produces a year, right? You do 2 million tons a year, you're doing 500,000 tons a quarter, which means you're getting 250,000 tons a quarter in military steel. So, how does that break out in terms of the industrial capability of European countries based on points Wow. We start off with the United States of America. On that basis, 25 points of steel per quarter. Their base is 25, which is to say 50 million tons of steel is what the U.S. is cranking out per year in 1939. By 1943, that goes up to 45 points, okay? 90 million tons of steel. The U.S., in 1939, the U.S. steel industry really has not recovered from the Great Depression. There's an enormous amount of unused capacity, and all of that gets brought back into production. Germany starts off with 11 points. That's 22 million tons of steel a year. By 1943, they peak at 17 points, or 34 million tons of steel a year. We'll talk a little bit more about that in the next slide as to what that means and how that happened. The Soviet Union, 9 points, 18 million tons of steel, down to between 5 and 6 points by 1943 due to the loss of industry having been overrun by the Germans. And you've heard, and it's absolutely true, the Soviets did heroic, incredible things in terms of relocating their industry to the Urals and flat cars with machine tools on them and getting them there and working under tents for a while. None of that is true, but the one thing you can't move is a blast furnace. It won't fit on a flat car, And the steel industry, the real productive part of the steel industry that the Soviets had in the areas overrun by the Germans, they couldn't move and they lost, and it made an impact on Soviet production that was felt dramatically throughout the war. It really hurt their production. And it wasn't until late in the war that they started getting some of that production back as they kind of retook the Donbass and some of those areas. United Kingdom, 7 points, 14 million tons. France, about 8 million tons. Sweden, 3 million. Belgium, France is 8 million. Sweden is 6 million. Belgium is 4 million. Italy, 2 million. Belgium outproduces Italy in steel. Which shows there's a great story as to how, and I haven't found it because I've got a lot of other things on my mind, but someday I'd like to track down how in the world Italy managed to build the navy they did before World War II, because they have a really good navy. But the steel industry, how did they do that? I think there's a terrific story in that someday. Maybe someday I'll track it down. Poland, Spain, Canada, and Australia all have about the same size steel industry, about 2 million tons a year. So that's where the industrial muscle is and how it shakes out among your European countries. Let's see here. German industrial expansion. You've heard a lot about Albert Speer taking over, improving the efficiency of German industry and all this stuff, and there's some truth in that. But in terms of raw numbers of steel, he didn't have much effect. German domestic production remained unchanged throughout the war. All of the expansion of German steel production comes from bringing online captured steel mills in other countries. They overrun the Polish industry in 1939. They overrun the Belgian and French industry in 1940. And in 1941, they overrun a big chunk of the Soviet steel industry. And about a year later, in each case, that stuff's coming online. So they add, they go from about, let's go back a slide. They start with 11 points, 22 million tons, and they go up to 17 points by 1943. Those 11 points of domestic steel don't change. What they add is all captured foreign stuff, 1.40 from Poland. In 41, they bring online most of the stuff from France and Belgium. In 42, they bring online the captured stuff from the Soviet Union. In 43, it stays the same level, and in 45, it goes down a point because they lose those Soviet steel mills. I mean, and you can just exactly trace where the steel's coming from. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? So what are the Germans making with steel? And I'm going to concentrate on the Germans here because people... love the Germans, to look at the Germans and how it worked, which means there's a wealth of information out there about the Germans. People really kind of poured through German stuff in detail. And so you can find a lot of interesting stuff about them. In the last quarter of 1939, which is the first full quarter of World War II, this is how the Germans allocate their steel production. The Army gets 17%, the Air Force gets 12%, military construction and fortifications gets 12%, the Navy gets 7%, total military is 48%. Domestic civilian sector gets 42%, and they export 10%. So it's just about 50-50. This is interesting. Look at how much they're putting into military construction and fortifications. Look at how little the Navy's giving. One of the first things that they do when the war breaks out is about half of the big heavy ships that they're building, scrap them. you're right off the bat. Those things get pulled out. They recover the steel that's already in them, and nothing's going into the big long-term naval building effort after that.
Are you looking at Germany as including Austria and Hungary too?
Well, not Hungary. This is not World War I, this is World War II. So Hungary is a separate country. Austria was a separate country until the Anschluss, when it joined Germany. So Austria is part, Vienna and Austria are part of Germany at this time, legally part of Germany. Hungary is a separate country and it's got no real steel industry and not a real big population. So, what's the Army building? And the answer to this is ammunition. Yeah, what's your question?
Yeah, on the Navy, if most of the stuff got scrapped from the Navy, was most of the building for U-boats then?
Yes. They kept building the Bismarck, the Tirpitz, a couple of cruisers, and they ended up building some destroyers. But from then on, most of the naval, almost all the new stuff laid down was U-boats from then on. They built a lot of U-boats. They really put a lot of U-boats in order. Yes?
So did total steel allocated to the Navy stay about the same, just that it was reallocated from large ships to
No, I think I don't remember the exact, but it actually goes down because U-boats don't take much steel. So the Navy gets a smaller chunk of the allocation, especially once the big ships get done. Once the Bismarck and Tirpitz are done, there's not as much steel going into the Navy. One of the interesting questions about industrial production in World War II is you see all these. Yeah, we kind of know Germany's got a big industrial, however you measure it, Germany's an industrial powerhouse. But then when you look at the production numbers of tanks built and airplanes built and this and that, it always looks like the Soviets are outproducing the Germans in a lot of key areas. And I always kind of wonder, how is that? I mean, were the Germans really just like the Keystone Cops? You know, they just couldn't get out of their own way. Is that why they couldn't, when the Soviets with a smaller industrial base and having to relocate a lot of their factories, still end up outproducing them? And the answer is that all those comparative production things never list the one thing that the Germans put at the top of their production priority list, which is artillery ammunition. That was Germany's number one military production priority throughout the war in terms of steel allocation. So, in 1944, this is kind of interesting. In 1944, the Germans allocate 4.8 million tons of steel to artillery ammunition production. Soviet total steel output that year was about 11 million tons, and about half of that went to the civilian sector. So the Germans in 1944 put almost as much steel into ammunition production as the Soviets put into all military production. That's how much steel the Germans were putting into military ammunition. And they were outproducing everybody in the world. In 44, Germany produces 281 million artillery rounds. The USA, for all theaters, okay, including naval, ordnance, everything else, only produces 227 million. The Soviets only produce 95 million artillery rounds, and the Soviet artillery rounds, on average, are lighter. Okay, I mean, their basic divisional weapons are the 75 instead of the 105. Their divisional howitzers are 122s instead of 150s. I mean, there's the generally, which means that and because of the square cube law, that means their shells weigh a lot less. So this 95 million artillery rounds is not the equivalent of 200 of 95. I mean, this is, you know, Germany's outproducing the Soviets in terms of tonnage, probably between 4 and 6 to 1. And of course, that's 4 and 6 to 1 times as much bang on the receiving end. Now, part of the reason for that is because of Germany's commitment to air defense. As the bomber offensive goes on, they build a lot of anti-aircraft guns, heavy anti-aircraft guns, all around Germany, and they shoot a lot of steel up into the air at the 8th Air Force. Nevertheless, this explains one of the reasons why some of the production figures look kind of weird, that nobody's looking at, very few people are looking at the one area that the Germans really put their money and their steel into. So, oh, actually, I just talked to you. This is a slide that kind of does all that in detail, isn't it? Yeah.
Cool.
So, yeah, the Soviet output's exactly a third of the German output, but it suggests a steel investment of 1.6 million tons, but in fact, it's probably less than that. Soviets rely heavily on lighter caliber stuff, so I'm ahead of myself this slide. But you can see, I'll back up to that before we move to
question. Yes. A comment there, rather. Yeah, I would probably explain why, with the Soviet output and all that, but I was probably explaining their offensive was suddenly stopped cold.
Right. Absolutely. And that's an excellent point. Uh-huh. I mean, one of the things that always stops Soviet offensives is they run out of ammunition. I mean, and it's not just that they physically outrun their supply lines, but also, even if they didn't, they only got so much ammunition, and they build it up, and they boom, they do an offensive, and they blow all that ammunition out, and then they got to make some more. This is a major problem for them in 41 and 42, before they've really, when their production gets disrupted anyway. And over, I mean, they doing these costly counterattacks in 41. And when you start reading the kind of the deep memoirs of the, they're always saying, well, you know, we're getting slaughtered because our infantry's going on the top with no artillery support because we don't have any artillery ammunition. The one thing the Germans always have is artillery ammunition. And part of the reason is, you know, they believe in this elastic defense and counterattacking right away. When they counterattack, they've always got artillery behind them. I mean, it's a kind of a different approach there. The Soviets outgun the Germans significantly, which means that at the point of attack, they can pour a lot of ammunition in quickly, but over the course of the battle, they're going to run out of steam pretty quick, and the Germans always keep their guns fit. It's a different approach, but at least, I'm not going to make a judgment as to which one is a better approach, but I mean, I think it's interesting to understand. You can't kind of understand these production numbers unless you understand what motivated these decisions, okay? And that's kind of where how these guys come at this differently. So the third metric is fuel, but I'm not going to deal with coal because coal's where, you know, petroleum is really the crucial fuel in World War II. And again, the basic increment is 250 tons of crude oil. And there's kind of a logistical reason within the game for doing that. Some of these resources have to be shipped around. And if your basic increment of steel is 250,000 tons and your basic increment of oil is 250,000 tons, it really makes it easier to kind of have a generic system of moving stuff around. However, remember, each factory was kind of producing, each factory is producing one production point of steel. So that's how we did factories in the game. But oil tends to be more concentrated. You don't have, for the same amount of time, you don't have as many different production centers. You've got fewer centers. So an oil-producing hex produces 5 points of oil per quarter, or 1.2 million tons, which amounts to 5 million tons per year. So in terms of figuring out where oil resources are, if your oil production is divided by 5 million tons, and that gets you how many oil wells you get, each of which you produce 5 points a quarter. So 5 million tons per year is your threshold for an oil point or an oil center. How do they shake out? 1939, each point equals an annual output of 5 million tons. Europe produces 8 points, of which 6 are in the Soviet Union. 1 is synthetic oil produced in Germany by coal gasification, and Romania produces 1. So that's Asia in the Middle East produces 5 points. United Kingdom controls two in Iran, one in Iraq, one in India. The Netherlands produces one in the Indies. And in the Western Hemisphere, 37 points of oil, which later goes up to 44 by the end of the war. The world is producing 50 points of oil, or 250 million tons of oil a year. Of that, 74% is in the Western Hemisphere. 56% of the world's oil production is coming out of wells in the United States of America. On the face of it, this is not a contest, right? You look at this and you go, well, there's just no contest here. I mean, the United States, 28 million, later grew to 35 because we did a lot of additional drilling and extraction during the war. Venezuela, 6 points, it was 30 million. Mexico, one. Other South American and Caribbean countries, two. Yes, question.
I'm wondering if Russia or Germany were ever limited in their production for steel and oil just by the quarrying sites and the pumping sites, or were they actually just limited by factories and refineries?
They had pretty thoroughly exploited. Germany is just they're restricted by how many coal gasification plants they've built, and how much coal goes into them. They're pretty expensive, and they build more as things go on. But they're mostly just kind of keep up with what the bombers are knocking out. Oil, the Soviets pretty thoroughly had exploited exploiting their reserves. So it's not like they could drill. At that time, a lot more fields. I mean, they ended up doing some more, but they did a pretty good job of exploiting the resource, the fields, the reserves that they knew of. Yes, Anne.
I don't see Saudi Arabia.
No, the Saudi Arabia fields were not really opened yet. The Kuwait fields were not really open. They didn't really, they were still looking. The big fields were in Iraq and Iran. And all the stuff south of there kind of gets explored in the immediate port, explored and developed after the war. Yeah, so there's nothing coming out of Saudi Arabia at this time. I mean, it really is just a desert at this time. It's completely transformed in the post-war world. There is something to remember about this enormous number down here for the U.S., and that is that the U.S. is a really big place. So is the Soviet Union, for that matter. Really big places, which means that it takes a lot of fuel to move stuff around in the civilian economy. And because the U.S. and the Soviet Union were relatively oil rich, they used oil for a lot of things that other people didn't use oil for. They used more oil heating and electrical generation than where other people used coal almost exclusively. And there's a lot more automobiles in the United States. And that adds up. So where does all the U.S. oil go? I mean, that's a good question. That's half of the world's oil production. Where's it going? In 1942, civilian use in increments of 5 million tons, our basic production thing. The United States uses 27 of those points. Of the 50 points in the world, the United States used 27 of them in civilian production, in civilian use. The rest of the Western Hemisphere, this only covers the allies, the Western allies, the U.S. and the Western allies, but this is their allocation of oil. The rest of the Western Hemisphere uses 4. The United Kingdom and neutral Europe use 1. For civilian, and the Middle East and Far East and Africa used 1. So total civilian use in the Western allies in 1942 was 33 points. In addition to that, 3 points were used by the merchant marine, bunker oil, moving stuff across back and forth across the ocean. Direct military use of the Western allies at that time was 5 points. Total 41 points. And if you look here, that 41 points is the 37 points you see here, and the 4 points controlled by Britain in Asia and the Middle East. That's where those points come from. So, only five points. Now, the Axis, effectively all their oil is going into military use, all 2 points of it. Okay, one from Romania, one from coal gasification, because they're very, you know, they're very serious about limiting gasoline use for anything else. The Soviets, about half. The Soviets, about half is going into military use, and half is going into the domestic economy. Yes?
What about rail transport within Germany?
Well, they have to use oil for that. Yeah, they have to use oil for that. And so there, you know, there's a lot going in. You know, there's some going into that. But wherever possible, they use coal for electro generation, for some movement along the Rhine River. They're using, you know, the coal for that. They convert cars to be basic coal burners. You know, kind of coal gasification things. Yeah, they do a lot. There's little oil reserves like in France and other places that they are mostly pulling out. If you see any wartime films made in France, you'll see these cars with these big tanks. They look like water tanks on the top or something, and they're actually that's a gasification thing. So the thing's not actually running on petrol. So over the course of the war for the Western Allies, civilian consumption remains constant. But remember, the U.S. was increasing its oil output. It's the increase that goes into military use. So in 42, a Western-wide military use is 5 points. In 43, it's up to 9. In 44, it's 13. In 1945, it would have been 16 based on the actual consumption. It doubled if the war had gone on the whole time.
Does that also include the figures that are going to the Far East?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Yes, it does. This is not just the ETO. This is the total, and a lot of it does go to the Far East. You know, a lot of it does. I mean, we had a big Navy and a big Air Force out there. Not as much ground movement, but there's a lot of the bulk of the U.S. fleets in the Pacific. Bulk of the U.S. Air Forces, the strategic air forces, tends to be in the ETO, but there's still a big air commitment in the Pacific. Is that it? Yes, that's it. That's the data. So that tells you kind of where this petroleum issue starts to become overwhelming by the end. Starts to become more. So the Germans really need to win. I mean, the upshot of the strategy is the Germans need to win quick. If this is a long war, they're in big trouble. And it's hard to figure out how they can get out of it. You can understand the importance of trying to go for the Caucasus oil, because in these terms, the Caucasus oil would almost triple Axis total oil production if they could get all of it into production. You know, the Baku field is enormous, an enormous field. It's hard to see how they could have gotten it all into production very easily. The pipelines, there's a lot of infrastructure they'd have to build. But still, you can understand why, at a certain point, if they're going to try to fight a long war, they've got to have that. They've got to have that oil in the Caucasus. Because without it, they're just screwed. And once they fail to get it, the real symptom of that is that from then on, the German military is just instructed not to make long-term strategic projections anymore, because they don't come out very good. Yes.
But it seems like even if they didn't capture the Caucasus, like you said, they would have had a hard time keeping in production. Mm-hmm. They would have had a hard time transporting it from there back to Germany, mm-hmm. defending it against partisans and, surgical strikes along the pipeline.
When it comes down, they've got to take out the player, because if the Russians aren't fighting anymore, then they don't. Then the defense that goes away, and having an oil field is a viable option. Mm-hmm. Same thing with taking England out.
But it also made the case that instead of going for the Caucasus oil fields, they went for the oil fields in the Middle East.
In the Middle East?
Yeah, because it's...
In some ways, the Caucasus is easier to get at,
even though it's easier to get at the Red Army.
If you think about the logistical difficulties that Rommel had getting to Egypt, which were effectively insurmountable, he's less than half of the way to the Middle East oil fields, and that's the easy half, because there at least he's got the Mediterranean coast. That is, he can take port. You can bring in supplies. You get past you get past Palestine, and there's this stretch where there are there's just nothing between there and, you know, I mean, how you supply, the British managed to supply a motorized cavalry brigade group across that to get to relieve Habaniya Airfield when they, during the Iraqi coup. Mm-hmm. There's just, I don't know how you supply an army, a real modern army with tanks and stuff across that, but especially since the British have Basra as a port at the other end and a major base to, you know, to
well,
to,
well, my thinking is that you have to go through 5 million Russian soldiers, you go through maybe 500,000 English soldiers. So,
but there,
and Arabs were more or less friendlier, at least in theory, to the Germans. But
well, that's because they didn't know them very well yet.
Exactly.
And that's where Germany's loss in World War I really pains them, because the Brits and the French pretty much split up the Middle East after that, and they were not going to give it up, and that's why. I mean, they really made a point of keeping that.
I will say this, without trying to bias one or another, just as objectively as I can, the maps in ETO go to Basra. Those oil fields are on the map. Good luck.
Okay. Well,
let me know if you take them.
Okay.
Yes.
If I get a copy of the game.
Yes.
I'm just wondering, though, ultimately, let's just come up with a fantasy scenario. Let's say that Germany never attacked France, never attacked England, and they focused everything on Russia, and they captured the Caucasus oil field, and they developed it, and they had all the oil they would ever need. Do you think, ultimately, they could have triumphed over Russia, or would they have just simply put off the inevitable for 10 years?
Well, how do you get to that fantasy scenario? How does the war begin?
Well, I guess
the Russians attack.
They first take over Poland.
Okay, at that point, France and Britain have declared war.
Oh yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm. Because when they attack Poland, France and Britain are now in the war.
Right. So
do you
just
leave
them? Although there was sort of a phony war that went for a while.
Yeah.
Let's say that Germany just garrisoned the western approaches to Germany, but did not commit their, you know, most of their army.
Oh boy, you better take out the Soviet Union really quick.
West Wall was the propaganda tool. It was actually a fortification.
Because the French have got a big army.
Yeah.
And it's not a bad army. I mean, in my opinion, terribly led from the highest level in 1940. They're not prepared. They're just psychologically and materially not prepared to deal with the Blitzkrieg. But the French army fought really hard. There's some battles. What is the Battle of Stone? This one German officer said, you know, I fought at Stalingrad. You know, I fought at, you know, a couple other places. Stone, that was the toughest battle I was ever in, you know. I mean, you don't think of these battles in France as being tough, but the French army fought at the unit level. Some of them fought very, very well. So, I mean, it's not a bad army, and you give them some time to get their act together, and you give the British time to mobilize their army and get it in the... And, boy, you're asking for trouble. I mean, those guys...
Wasn't it if the French had been able to mobilize the units that they had on the German border, they could have punched through, and you would have had the mobile army and the Germans coming down from the north on the coast, and the French would have been running up through the Rhine, right, at the same time.
Possibly. I mean, I don't think early on in the war the French were able to put together a mobile offensive.
Their style of offensive when they went in 1939 stopped like what, 5 miles inside the German border and took pictures and then retreated.
They didn't do that. I mean, what if they had taken their best units and instead of putting them to Belgium and put them to come to the Saar?
I forget if I was reading fiction or if I was reading a real event, but it was more of had they had the time, they would have executed. But their version of the Schifrin plan, mm-hmm. where the Germans always go through the Low Countries and the French spearhead right up on the other side of the Maginot Line,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
you know, because the Germans had to pull some stuff away from there to sit there and make the offensive work. So, you know, had they punched at that point, you know, then the Germans have got their mobile army down in there, and the French have cut off their supplies, so they run out of gas, you know. But it must have been fiction.
Yeah,
must have been fiction.
Yeah. Well, there was a book of alternates things. The big change was firing Weygand, replacing Gamelin with Weygand in 39. Who was actually a little, even though he was older, at least more on the ball, and appointing Charles de Gaulle as chief of staff.
Oh, that would have caused a coup.
I didn't write it. Somebody else did.
if not a coup, it would have drove a wedge between the French and the British.
Well, and between the French and the French. I mean, de Gaulle was not a popular officer at all in the French
I guess the guy who wrote that didn't think that.
Yeah. Frank, yes, Dan.
Two things.
Yes.
I would like to comment on this gentleman's question about the French offensive. World War I gutted the French psychologically, morally, and everything I've read, because I did my game Dunkirk 1940, and I was looking at that very stuff that you were just talking about. In other words, could the French do more than just limited counterattacks, which is what they did, mm-hmm. and they were quite effective in their own way. But they wouldn't sustain that. And the reason is, I really think it's psychological. Their government was absolutely opposed to major offensives. Their military had, those guys were young officers in World War I, and they remember what happened.
Yeah.
I mean, they got slaughtered. So they were just determined, we're not doing that again. This is not happening, which is why the Maginot Line was created. It's a defensive idea. Strategically, we're gonna let the Germans beat themselves against our fortifications and launch, you know, limited counterattacks. This is the psychology, this is the philosophy, and I just never saw anything where the French were going to do these massive blitzkrieg-type offenses or any kind of offensive on that level, like the Soviets did, like we did. But if you look even at our offensives, I mean, our army is really efficient. We're not going to throw people away like the Soviets are accused of doing, and it sure looks that way in terms of the number of bodies they lost. The French were never going to do that. Even in 44, the American Army lost its worst casualty levels going across Northwest Europe, even though we had a huge advantage in aircraft and artillery and all these other things. We lost huge numbers of people, and that's what happens. Offensives are, even when you're winning, they're expensive in human beings. And the French were just not going to do that. I can't see where, even when rebuilt their French army, on a limited basis that fought in Northwest Europe, they had to kick these guys and drag them and everything else. It isn't that they weren't willing to fight, they just weren't willing to fight on like that aggressive breakthrough and keep pushing for 100, 200 miles. It wasn't going to happen. So the French, I think, are more limited by that than any material limitations that they have this country.
Especially if you look at the success of their colonial troops, who weren't under that same psychological event. The Algerians have a reputation is just well known everywhere, and they were fighting in northwest France, and they were the ones who were making the French advances.
It's interesting that a substantial part of the French, the fighting French army, the Free French Army in northwest Europe is Africa.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, a big, big chunk of it is Africa.
Yeah.
They're French divisions, but, you know, it's formerly the 2nd Moroccan Division.
Yes.
Formerly the
That's right.
Yeah. The outfit had a disagreement with them, and they had told their general to move them away. Apparently, the Moroccans were stealing my dad's outfit supplies.
Well, so they were like Marines.
Well, to a lesser degree, the British are accused of this, that they fought to the last colonial. They use the Australians, the New Zealanders, and the South Africans. They use everybody else. The Free French. It's like push them in front of the Germans first.
South Africa had a thing where they would not fight outside of the continent of South Africa. I mean, Africa, excuse me. And the same thing, too, is the New Zealand Division. Okay, became the New Zealand Corps for like a week, I think, I don't know how long, but they got nailed in Italy.
No,
and after that, the New Zealand Corps ceased to exist as a formation.
Well, the New Zealand Corps was only the New Zealand Division, but Freiburg was senior enough
That he was respected enough that they could attach stuff to Freiburg and call it the New Zealand Corps. And it temporarily existed in North Africa, temporarily existed in Italy. But it wasn't like the New Zealanders got destroyed or anything. I mean, the New Zealanders had one division in the ETO.
Right.
And Freiburg was senior enough that sometimes he was an acting corps commander when stuff was attached.
He also had a benefit that no other general had. Everything had to go through his government to approval to use those New Zealand troops.
Because he was also contingent commander.
Yes.
Well, he was also the senior.
I mean, World War One. These guys, you know, remember Gallipoli, they remember the Western Front. And so their government said, you have to get us to approve how you're using our only one division that we have as a country.
That's right.
And so Freiburg, all they had to do was have veto power. You know, Montgomery could say, you're going to spearhead this. And he's like, no, that's not happening. You know?
Give it a fresh air, don't do anything.
Well, but, you know, there are a lot of things that make it difficult for some of these countries to fight on the same all-out way that the Soviets had to do. I mean, they didn't have a choice. So all these ideas that they make a separate peace with Germany, it's like, I don't think so, because how can they trust them, you know?
But I also want to, before we leave the wrong impression, I mean, a substantial part of the fighting French army, the Free French Army, was African. I mean, the parts that were French fought really hard.
Yes.
I mean, it's not like the French guys were dogging it and pushing the Moroccans up front. I mean, that's not really what was going on. The French in that army fought really hard. It's really easy to kind of stereotype these things, but usually the complexity of the truth is a lot more interesting. Yes.
I have a location for you if you want to start looking at that Italian steel.
That what?
The Italian steel.
Oh yes.
Up early on. Most of the Italian industrial trade and for those kinds of resources from the Middle Ages on is through the Balkans.
Uh-huh.
So while a lot of Austria went to Germany, that's where a lot of theirs were, the stuff in Slovakia, and in between the oil fields in Bulgaria, I believe is where a lot of the Italian trade may be coming from.
Okay.
I actually can look that up and
and there is, Yugoslavia has not enough steel to show up as an industrial point, but Yugoslavia has a fledgling steel industry at this
point. And I think they traded through Italy because it's very funny. Everybody thinks that you envision all the Western nations trading with each other. People tend to forget Italy looked east from the beginning of time and traded extensively for resources in that area. And I think that's how a lot of it, they don't really trade a lot of it with Russia. And so the Italians are there and have been there for centuries. So I think that is where some of it may come from.
That's possibly true, too. At least prior to the war, they probably got some steel from the United States.
It's possible.
I know they got, I remember the third, when they, Ethiopia, made, I mean, when they hit in Ethiopia, Britain and France started an embargo against Italy, but it didn't work because the United States still was still supplying oil and they were to the Italians. And the Italians kept fighting, it was the Ethiopians. But anyway, so the embargo wasn't working because they had to work around inadvertently through us.
It might be interesting to see if any of those Italian ships were actually manufactured, built in the United States.
No. They were modern ships, right? They were pretty much modern ships.
They were mostly built.
Yeah.
Some of them were late World War One battleships, renovated, and then there's a new class of battleships that they built, large battleships that they built.
And Jack Green is an expert on the Italians. You might want to ask
him. That's true.
He would know.
The biggest thing the British were afraid of was the Italian and the French Navy going, the Italians or the French Navy going to the Italians, and they would have been outclassed in the Mediterranean.
Yeah. Yes.
Going back to production in Germany and about tanks and all that, I remember reading Guderian's memoirs that there was a orders that had come out to upgrade the cannons on the Mark III's and Mark IV's to 50 millimeter, the Mark IV's to 75, but it got lost in the paperwork, and they didn't do it right away. And the other thing too was his position as Inspector General of the Armed Forces only did not include all the assault guns because apparently the artillery had them.
No, it didn't. His position did.
Yeah. Well, what was the thing to do with?
They'd been under the artillery until he was appointed Inspector of Armored Forces, and then they specifically came under his.
Okay, good. Yeah, I guess he was having his sour grapes about something because the English translation I read said he still didn't have control. But anyway,
sure he did.
But okay, at least not right away, but it got changed. And the other thing too is there was a picture I've seen on the internet. I know the internet is the source of all wisdom, but not really. But anyway, there's this picture that says it compares a contrast between a German production crew working on tanks and a Russian crew, and there's all these Russians working on the same tank, and there's a German tank sitting there, and there's a couple guys like having coffee, and a couple of guys apparently BSing, and maybe one guy working on the tank, and I don't know when that picture was taken.
Yeah.
Sense of urgency in Germany was not there in 1942, where it might have made a difference.
Although, yeah. I mean, I heard another interesting. This is from a memoir of a fellow was touring aircraft factories. This is right before the war, and he went to this French factory, and he was really impressed. Because it was clear that the factory workers really cared about the airplanes they were building and were doing it, making sure that these airplanes were just really, every one of them was as good as they could make it. And they were happy to explain to this guy what they were doing and what their jobs were, and it was clear their level of commitment to turning out a thing. And he says that he went to a German factory, and he couldn't carry on that conversation because the sound of power tools was deafening. But the French factory, they were like screwing in the screws, and in the German factory, it was just And so he was impressed in an entirely different way. Yeah.
Go ahead.
So the fact that the Germans were producing four times as many shells as the Russians, if they changed that mix a little bit and maybe produced more equipment, right, to fire the shells, right, you think it might have made a difference in a couple of the battles? I mean, at least early on. I understand for the elastic defense, but if they had more stuff on the ground to sit there and fire the guns, to fire the shells, it might have made a...
It might have. I mean, early on, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that the problem is material. It is a difference in material superiority. I think they've got the stuff to get the job done. The problem is, Soviet Union is a big place, and they just don't have the ability. Maybe if they built more trucks, because they really just have this problem. So. It's as if they looked at the maps and forgot that the scale was different,
you read the stuff where the Germans have got, all the self-propelled stuff, but wasn't the German artillery still horse-toed?
Well, everybody's artillery is horse-toed except the British and the Americans. I mean, that's... Everybody in Europe is horse-drawn stuff except for the British. So there's kind of this myth that, you can tell the Germans are losing because they use horses. Who doesn't? I mean, the Soviets Soviet artillery is horse-drawn.
Well, but it's keeping up with the front, right? If everybody else is advancing a lot at mechanized speeds, and you've got the artillery crawling.
Basically, all of the German army is horse-drawn except for the Schnell troop and the fast troops, the Panzers and motorized, and some of the core artillery. A lot of the core artillery is motorized, and all of the anti-aircraft is motorized. Is motor drawn, but the bulk of the infantry is horse drawn, and that's also that's true. That's also true of the Red Army. The Red Army within a Soviet rifle division, I think the only thing that's motorized is the anti-tank battalion and maybe the anti-aircraft battalion. The anti-tank and the anti-aircraft battalion are motorized, but all the divisional artillery is horsepower. So you just can't improvise a giant motor industry. There's some really good logistical reasons to switch to. The reason the British are completely, we see motorized, I mean, their infantry still walks, but there's no horses in the division. All the transport is done by motor vehicles. All the guns are towed by motor vehicles. That's what the British Army being motorized means in 1939-40. The supply advantages of that are that gasoline is a much higher energy density than oats. You know?
Yeah.
You know, to get the same amount of work done, you got to put less gasoline in terms of tonnage into the truck than you have to put oats into the horses. And when you're not using the truck, you don't have to keep putting gas in it. Whereas if you buy the horse, you got to keep putting the oats in.
Yeah.
You know, or pretty soon they start smelling bad.
You might eat well one night.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there's a lot of supply advantages to a motorized army, but it also takes a pretty extensive industrial base in proportion with the size of the army to pull it off. We did it, and the British did it. Nobody else in World War II anywhere pulled that off.
Yeah,
if we hadn't had as much oil production, we probably wouldn't have done it either.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, if you've got the oil to do it, it makes enormous sense on the battlefield in terms of the tonnage you have to carry to get stuff done. But you've got to have the oil to do it.
But we had to have the oil just to get to the battlefield.
Yes.
I mean, because we weren't fighting on home turf. We were fighting
right.
Two disparate wars. Mm-hmm. You know, each 3,000 miles away from home. So it seems that...
And that influences all sorts of decisions. You know,
it does.
When the Soviets start getting Sherman tanks, initially they're not really happy. They actually end up really happy with the Sherman tank by the end of the war. But initially they say, you know, the tracks are so narrow. You know, it's not really very good.
Yeah.
Well, that's because they're designed to fit on a ship. You know, that's going to take it across the Atlantic Ocean. You know, so there's all these design constraints on a Sherman tank and a lot of our vehicles in terms of, you know, people say, why didn't we ever have a motorized infantry division? Well, because they did the numbers. And it takes as much shipping tonnage to put a motorized infantry division across the Atlantic as it does an armored division. What would you rather have? You know? there's all these, this notion of what it takes to get it across the Atlantic into the war has influences on force structure and the design of specific equipment. I mean, it's got enormous ramifications. We haven't heard from you. Right. Go ahead.
Where were we getting the majority of our oil from?
Us.
Texas?
Texas, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, Pennzoil. Quaker State, you know, Pennsylvania, before the big strikes in Texas, was the largest oil field in the world. But by this time, Texas and Oklahoma were coming up. But yeah, earlier on I mentioned that at this time, the United States is producing 56% of all the oil in the world. 56% of global production is coming out of wells in the United States. Dana, you
Going back to your game, now that you've done this wonderful research,
okay.
You're basically saying, Germany can't win, why are you playing this game?
Germany, if it goes on, that's one of the reasons that the game ends in 45, okay? There's no point in going on past 45. I mean, the Germans have got to get the job done early. And how they go about that is, I mean, to me it looks like, it's not like we sat and played this monster game 20 times, you know? This is still all, you know. But to me it looks like you got to smack the Soviet Union really hard. But the way things went to a certain extent are dictated by some hard realities. I mean, you can't turn east until you've secured the west. I mean, and that means at a minimum, I think, taking out France and having the English Channel instead of the Rhine as your western defenses.
Well, and taking out England itself.
Well, you could try, and it's possible, but I think it's just a long shot. I mean, the Battle of Britain's got to work, and
replace Pierre with somebody actually can command an air force.
The
in the war game though.
Yeah, I. it's really tough to take out the RAF. Really tough. And if you don't take out the RAF, and you can't take out the Royal Navy, it's hard to see how you make Sea Lion work. You know, I mean, we're going to land these guys here. Well, what happens when the Royal Navy comes through the English Channel and just blows all your transports up? Or we're going to sink Mustukas. Well, what are you going to do when the RAF is still in the air? I mean, there's some really hard things. It's hard to make all these pieces work to take out England. You can try. It's not impossible, but I mean, it's not like, well, they should have just done this. What exactly, other than what they did?
So. Do you also have political aspects in the game in terms of not just military? Because I think the only way to knock out Britain is that Churchill's not prime minister.
Well, we don't have that. I don't think that's necessarily.
Well, there was a big debate in the cabinet about, you know, remember,
sure.
Between those who said we want to keep what we have of the British Empire. Uh-huh. That if we do this, we're going to go broke. It has nothing to do with whether we can continue to fight. Uh-huh. It's like Churchill saying we have to fight on, even though that, you know, the classic.
We don't have that very personal aspect of what one guy's position makes, but the purpose of the way the game works is every nation has a national morale level.
Okay.
And when their morale, when you push their morale to zero, they give up.
They say that's it.
And the object of the game is, you know, so the kind of the ongoing object is to knock that morale down. There's things you can do to increase your morale, like the Italians in 1941 demobilized like half their army and send it home. If you demobilize your army, if you put guys in the replacement pool, if you've got a big accumulated replacement pool, that bumps your morale up. So there's reasons for keeping people out of the army. But the object is to knock that down. And that's one of the reasons you have the shipping war. You're trying to knock down the British have a certain strategic convoy level they have to maintain. If you can knock that down with U-boats, then they have to either pay a price in production or morale. If you bomb industrial cities that and successfully do it, they have to pay either that either have it not produce or lose a morale point. There are ways of banging at and if you take cities on the ground, that lowers morale. So there's a couple different ways to go with this morale thing. You kind of have to do a combination of things to usually make it work. But in the case of Britain, you've got to knock the morale down. And at a certain point, they'll give up. And for the major powers, giving up doesn't mean giving up. It means a settled peace where you occupy Great Britain, the colonies fight on, you know, the colonies, you know, the dominions, the Commonwealth fights on, probably after a ceasefire for a certain period of time. And if you knock out the Soviet Union, you're not going to knock the Soviet Union out. You're going to negotiate a treaty that pushes the Soviet government back across the Urals, and that treaty will probably hold for 6 months to a year, and then you're going to have to deal with these guys again, probably. But all these things, but that gives you time to go, you know, deal with some other things. So that's kind of how the game, you know, that's kind of how the game, the politics of the game works at the great power level.
How big is the space the game takes up? I mean, it's a monster game, so how many maps and so forth do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I should know.
A 12-foot map, a 6-foot map?
No, it's probably closer to 12 feet.
Okay.
But you can play it in segments. You can play the East Front, you can play the West Front, you can play the Arctic Front, and you can play the Mediterranean. And those, it's kind of those four sub-theaters. And each one of those is, you know, a couple maps. The Eastern Front is three good-sized maps, I think, covers the whole Eastern Front. And then you can put it all together, probably still keep it on separate tables and go from table to table to do stuff. It would be hard to reach if you put all the stuff together.
When will it be out?
Oh, that's... Who can say?
2017.
But the current plan is it will be out in four major installments, the first of which will be The War in the East. And that will be available for playtesting next summer, and then possibly available by the end of the year, although Alan, I don't think ever wants to say a tentative date until it's really, really firm. But we're looking we've been doing some playtesting, but a complete playtest version of the game, kind of production, final production quality, will be available next summer.
which will debut at Consum World Expo, and we'll go from there. And then hopefully the other games can follow one or two a year. So there's those four games, and there'll be a wrap up where you do this strategic, you know, this kind of everything kind of plugs together, and you also get partisan war and the convoy war. So are we about wrapped up then, or
You know what? Thank you, Frank. Oh,